The Spectator magazine is the greatest magazine in the English language. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online to see for yourselves. Also, against my advice as editor, we're giving away a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Given that you're spending 12 quid, you can do the maths. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Each week we choose some of our favourite pieces from the magazine and ask their writers to read them out loud. I'm Patrick Gibbons, and on the podcast this week, reporting from St Helena, Douglas Murray reflects on the inhabitants he has met and the history of the British Overseas Territory. After the CAS report's conclusions into transgender care from the NHS, Lionel Shriver opines on the positioning of the debate. Following a boyhood dream to visit the country to watch cricket, Mark Mason reads his letter from India as he travels there with his son. And Taylor Swift's new album may be titled The Tortured Poets Department, but there is precious little poetry if Graham Thompson's review is anything to go by. Up first, Douglas Murray.
In an attempt to escape from the world, I have come with friends to St Helena. It is quite a good place for the exercise. Until a few years ago, the only way to get to the island was a 5-day boat voyage from Cape Town. Shortly before COVID, an airport for this British Overseas Territory was finally completed at UK taxpayer expense. To protect some local insects, the runway was put at a slightly wrong angle, making it difficult, sometimes impossible, to land. The weekly flight from Johannesburg, therefore, refuels in Namibia in case landing is impossible and the plane has to about turn. Jamestown is not the busiest metropolis, but for the island's population of around 4,000 people, this harbour town is the hub. The Consulate Hotel on the main street running down to the sea is run by the lovely Hazel and is a warren of rooms and memorabilia relating to the island. A life-size statue of Napoleon Bonaparte stands on the balcony overlooking the street. It takes a few days to get used to him being over your shoulder as you take a morning coffee or the first drink of the day. Exploring the hotel, I found a grand piano and put my fingers to work. While playable, it was slightly out of tune. I inquired whether this could be fixed, and it was explained that the island's piano tuner is in jail. Down by the harbour that evening, I got chatting to a local friend who, like all the other islanders, attended the only school, which is named after Prince Andrew. I asked her whether it would be possible to spring the piano tuner from the local chokey, even for a few hours. She told me that St Helena's prison is at capacity. Even on holiday, this is the sort of thing that interests me. I learned that there is one murderer on the island, happily now free, but that most of the inmates were there for the sort of sex offences that regrettably happen in small, remote communities where people are related. As we were having this conversation, I became aware of a local drunk looking at us. I occasionally darted a look to check he wasn't overhearing. He was, and sloped towards our table. "I ain't no paedophile," he said. "I don't believe I said you were," I replied. "I ain't sold no children," he went on. "You was looking at me whole time you have that talk." Slipping into the fascinating local patois, my friend managed to talk him down. We avoided further crowding the prison and parted with a reassurance from me that I agreed he had never sold his daughters. Of course, the most famous prisoner to have been on this island was Napoleon. One night we had a glorious dinner at his island abode, Longwood House, which has been magnificently restored. The view from Napoleon's quarters is one of the best on the island, which is saying something. It is like a mini world out there, with vast mountain crops, lush greenery, and of course thousands of miles of empty ocean. People are no longer brought up to believe in the great man view of history, but you cannot doubt it here. There is a startling aura about the place. The idea that this man required battalions of British troops to be stationed on the island, forts on every hilltop, and a fleet of British ships surrounding it just to keep him confined, is testament to the fact that whatever else he got wrong, he was a great man. One of my friends caught me alone in Napoleon's coffee parlour, staring out across the South Atlantic. "What are you thinking about?" he asked. "Europe, Moscow," I told him. I have been unfair to the local inhabitants. Most of the saints, as they are known, are superlatively lovely people. During the Sunday morning service, the sign of the peace bit involved meeting the whole congregation. They are also a genuinely diverse people, with a DNA pool which is as mixed as any on Earth. And they are proud of their British status, without any of the concomitant guilts forced on us at home. During the long and ruinous construction of the airport, the bones of several hundred former slaves were uncovered. They turned out to be the bones of slaves freed by the British from Portuguese ships. St. Helena was a crucial port for the West Africa squadron, tasked with stamping out the slave trade across the high seas. One local piece of development is the rebuilding of Toby's Cottage. This is the former residence of a slave who became friends with Napoleon and to whom Napoleon gave a sum of money to be free. Today, neither credit cards nor debit cards work on the island. Phones barely do, and the Wi-Fi is patchy. To get money, you have to go to the only branch of the island's bank, show plenty of ID, and sign many forms. With my £50, plus commission, I can stand drinks for several nights. This is the sort of solitude I seek. I catch up on a pile of books, swim in the harbour, and say hello to people I haven't seen for hours. The most striking thing about the island is not just its lushness, but its extraordinary biodiversity. There are about 5 different landscapes across the island, from ones that look like the moon to others that look like England, and others that look like nowhere else on Earth. Down by the ocean is a memorial to the dead of the island from the 2 world wars, and also a memorial to the crew of RFA Darkdale, which was torpedoed at anchor off St. Helena in the early hours of the 22nd of October 1941. The roll call of the dead includes a 30-year-old Neil McMillan from Stornoway and a 27-year-old John MacLeod, second radio officer, from the Hebridean village my father grew up in. Like many a previous inhabitant of the island, I walk away reflecting that even when you come to the uttermost parts of the earth, home follows you.
That was Douglas Murray. Next, Lionel Shriver.
Following the release of the CAS report deprecating NHS gender-affirming care for minors as reliant on rubbish medical research, the number of comment pieces disparaging the cult of transgenderism has exploded. Such columns would never have been published even a couple of years ago. Finally, pushing disturbed children and adolescents into damaging and sometimes gruesome treatment in the service of adult fanaticism is starting to look, iffy. For outliers who've been frantically signaling, hey, maybe a society that's mutilating its own kids has lost its way. This watershed should constitute satisfying vindication. It does. That's the good news. The bad news. The lie that you can choose to be whichever sex you feel like is entrenched in Britain's school system. Activist teachers who've blithely ignored cautious government guidance aren't likely to drop their warped gender-bred lesson plans or their exciting collusion with children against their own parents, merely because of a spot of bad press. The fashion for sexually neutral language that gave us birthing people and bonus holes is embedded in the NHS, the media, and many corporations. And these dehumanizing linguistic abortions won't likely evaporate overnight. Pronoun badges may eventually be preserved behind museum glass as fascinating artifacts from an era in which the West lost its collective mind. But for now, they're still garnishing lapels and aren't yet subject to widespread social derision. Preferred pronouns in emails continue to helpfully inform recipients that the correspondent is either a frightened conformist or a proud conformist. Transgenderism is even more sanctified in the United States, where support for inadequately trialed experimental drugs and permanently disfiguring surgeries, even for children, remains the ultimate progressive purity test. Only a deluge of lawsuits is apt to dislodge the catechism in America. The president wants biological men in women's sports. For the past decade or so, the cultural glorification of what was once sensibly characterized as a rare mental illness has displayed all the hallmarks of an irrational social mania. The fact that we all got the message from the off that if we're not on board with this stuff, we'd better keep our mouths shut is a red flag. Proper manias sweep virtually everyone up in their whirlwinds, and woe to anyone who clings to reality as if clutching a signpost in a gale. Social hysteria does not permit dissent. Those few who refuse to get with the program will pay the price with exile, opprobrium, and professional disgrace, if not, amidst the very worst of our communal insanities, with prison or death. We like to think of ourselves as unique individuals, but in a crowd, we're a hive species. In the thick of mass psychosis, profits are unwelcome. It rarely pays to be ahead of your time. Even as this perverse infatuation with pretending to change sex subsides, commentators who stuck their necks out and pleaded for us all to get a grip are not assured any retroactive recognition. My colleagues J.K. Rowling, Helen Joyce, Julie Bindel, Abigail Schreier, and Kathleen Stock won't necessarily benefit from their foresight. When a communal derangement ebbs, everyone who got caught up in the craze feels a bit abashed and wants to forget all about it. Mavericks who bucked the trend are unpleasant reminders of everyone else's cowardice. As a rule, no one ever thanks apostates, much less apologizes for the grief, insult, and ostracism they bore. In kind, the chances are poor that all the clinicians, teachers, therapists, activists, and politicians who powered the trans assembly line will ever be held to account. In 1633, the Inquisition found Galileo guilty of propagating the Copernican theory that the Earth revolves around the sun. He was sentenced to life imprisonment. It took 124 years for the astronomer's heliocentric dissertation to be removed from the Catholic Church's list of banned books. It took 187 years for the Church to permit Copernican teaching. Only in 1992 did a pope formally correct the long-standing wrong of the Church's condemnation of Galileo, 359 years later. We now surely dwell in the very eye of another manic social hurricane, the unfalsifiable theory of purely anthropogenic climate collapse. Put aside for a moment the debate we're not even allowed to conduct over the settled science, an oxymoron. For sheer argument's sake, let's suppose that the computer modeling-driven construct proves wrong-headed. If we didn't fully acknowledge that Galileo was spot on for 359 years, how long could it take for man-made global boiling to be declared a busted flush? Vast are the vested interests in this latest belief system, which flatters our transitory species as capable of dialing the average temperature of our whole planet up or down. Frankly, I can't see this dogma being officially debunked during my lifetime, even if we quietly suspect for years that it's hogwash. The deniers will keep being called names and losing their jobs. If it turns out that the skeptics were right, no one will ever thank them or apologize, just as vindicated lockdown skeptics get little credit today. I have my own depressing theory. It's credibly to our evolutionary advantage to be conformists. At any given time, your chances of survival are greater if you parrot exactly what other people around you are saying and claim to believe exactly what everyone else around you claims to believe. None of this marching to a different drummer. Don't call attention to yourself. Just try to blend in. Even in secular societies, heretics are in statistically high danger of defenestration or immolation, if only metaphorically. Starting circa 2012, then, you were super smart to have exalted the transing of children as humanity's glorious liberation from dumpy old biological sex. Maybe starting around 2024, you're also super smart to wonder aloud to your friends whether arresting adolescence's normal endocrinological development into adulthood and chopping off their healthy body parts is a totally good idea. Then, round about 2026 or so, I bet you'll be best off pretending you never bought into this breathtaking medical scandal to begin with.
That was Lionel Shriver. Now, Mark Mason.
The first thing I do is turn my watch upside down. India is 5.5 hours ahead of the UK, so the trick does the conversion for you. Well, sort of. A time like 11:40 works perfectly, becoming 5:10. But anything on the half hour leaves you guessing which number the shorthand should be pointing to. Still, it feels appropriate, because I learned it from Christopher Martin Jenkins on Test Match Special. And cricket is the reason my son and I are here. Our first match is in Jaipur, where the Rajasthan Royals host the Delhi Capitals. Ever since I was Barney's age, 14, I've wanted to visit this country and experience its national religion. And these days, that means the Indian Premier League. The match is an evening one, so the temperature has dipped to a comfortable level. Samosa and fizzy drink sellers wander the stands, music pumps and the announcer yells, and everywhere is a sea of pink flags. There's a roar as the Royals openers walk out, one of them Joss Butler. Barn and I feel guilty for jinxing him because he only makes 11, but Riyan Parag holds the innings together and in the last over he really pulls the trigger. 3 fours and 2 sixes. Each time the white ball soars into the night sky, picked out by the floodlights, the entire crowd rises to its feet as though they're tied to it. The assault proves decisive, the Royals end up winning by 12. The fans are ecstatic and I feel 14 again. Drivers in India need 3 things, we're told. Good horn, good brakes and good luck. But actually, they're wrong about the last one. The roads are as entertainingly chaotic as I've been promised, but we don't see a single collision. We should all drive like this. Knowing you've got to keep your wits about you means you keep your wits about you. It's pleasing evidence for the libertarian case, rather like that town in Holland that abolished traffic lights. There are cows lying across the road, and at one point we see a tuk-tuk carrying a motorbike on the back. I bet the reverse is out there somewhere too. I once published a book called Lost in Translation, a collection of unintentionally funny English from around the world. The trip provides plenty more material, from We Believes in Quality, a shop in Agra, and Ladies Frisking Point, a security check on the Delhi Metro, to a restaurant called The Charcoal Chimney and a brand of fireworks called Cock. As Barry Cryer used to tell us, never lose touch with silly. Favourite aspect of the Taj Mahal? The bartering monkeys, who steal sunglasses and wallets not because they want them, but so they can return them in exchange for food. One sits contentedly chomping on an ice cream with flake. In Mumbai, we visit the Oval Maidan, the public park with 8 cricket pitches down the middle, their outfields overlapping so that long on in one match stands next to fine leg in another. A youth team from Mumbai Cricket Club proudly tell us of their tour to England last year. The only match they lost was to Harrow, though they did beat Eton. Surely this means they should be allowed to take the latter's place in this year's fixture at Lord's. It turns out that our hotel, the Trident, is where the Mumbai Indians stay. Rohit Sharma and Jasprit Bumrah get huge cheers whenever they walk through reception. But then Sachin Tendulkar appears, and it's a different level. He walks quickly to the lift before anyone can register he's there, and as the doors close, everyone crowds round like iron filings round a magnet. They're left comparing photos on their phones. You can see why Sachin used to need disguises to go out and would drive his Porsche on the freeways at 4 a.m. just to feel alone. Mumbai's opponents are the Delhi Capitals, who again come off second best. The announcer is even better than the one at Jaipur. He's a cross between Brian Blessed and the guy who does the boxing in Vegas. "I say boom boom," he instructs us. "You say Bumrah." 30,000 people obey. And then Jasprit himself starts that beautifully quirky run-up. He walks most of it, only running the last 8 paces because that's all the room he had in his backyard as a kid. But the ball comes out like a rocket and Prithvi Shaw's leg stump lights up red as it smacks against the ground. The stadium erupts. Bumrah's earning his money, about £1.2 million for the tournament. On our drive to the airport, we pass a shooting location for Slumdog Millionaire. "But in India, slum people are not the poor people," says our driver. "They are middle class. Poor people are the street people." I remember the guy who told us, incorrectly but with a broad smile, that this year the value of the IPL is greater than Pakistan's GDP. Boom, boom, indeed.
That was Mark Mason. Finally, Graham Thompson.
How to explain the supercharged star power of Taylor Swift? An undeniably gifted artist, Swift's albums 1989, Folklore, and Evermore in particular, are excellent. She has written a battery of terrific pop songs. She is a generous and skilled performer. To suggest she is overrated is not an insult, therefore, but simply a comment on the absurd critical mass of her popularity, in which every lyric, scrap of artwork, cultural reference and personal tidbit is weighted with a monumental significance which, it's becoming apparent, does her work few favours. Anybody listening to Swift's new albums without prior knowledge of the layers of gossipy context surrounding it might well wonder what all the fuss was about. There are perhaps half a dozen decent pop songs, a couple of pleasant piano ballads, a lot of mid-tempo, middling, meandering, and words, 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 crammed into every cranny like a chainsaw running through a dictionary. The Tortured Poets Department is a breakups album. It is, in some ways, a knowing exploration of what Swift terms the teenage petulance of romantic despair, deliberately overplaying emotions for dramatic and sometimes comic effect. Why else would a 30-something billionaire write a song called But Daddy, I Love Him? It is also a jab at all those cool, sad boys cradling guitars and overly groomed misery. Yet, my goodness, it's exhausting. While the commercially astute but artistically flawed plan to re-record every album she made for her previous label, Big Red Machine, continues apace, the Tortured Poets Department confirms the suspicion that Swift has no one around her to advise that less can be more. The album runs to 16 tracks, not counting another 15 on the surprise second volume, which only came as a surprise to anyone unaware of Swift's manic release schedule over the past few years. Underneath it all is a rather conservative songwriter, skilled in the Nashville tradition, and still in many ways beholden to its orthodoxies. Swift has not reinvented the wheel when it comes to writing or performing, but she has arguably reinvented the notion of stardom. She is closer to a phenomenally successful film franchise or a hit Netflix series than a musical artist. She is a brand, and the brand logo is a broken heart. The trouble with the Tortured Poets Department is that it prioritises soap opera over substance by pandering so completely to the appetites of her fan base. The game Swift is playing with her fans, to the slightly unseemly delight of both parties, if not perhaps the rest of us, is to determine whether she is writing about her long-term ex, British actor Joe Alwyn, her short-term ex, bratty British musician Matty Healy, or her current beau, American football star Travis Kelce. Having obsessive fans is one thing, but Swift seems increasingly obsessed with that obsession. She feeds the prurience of her devotees and elements of the media, while at the same time castigating them for it. Heading up the Having Your Cake and Eating It department is But Daddy, I Love Him, which states, I don't cater to all those vipers, while doing precisely that. Swift brings her Eras tour to the UK this summer, and on I Can Do It With a Broken Heart, she reminds the kids that when she sings for them, she will be smiling through a veil of tears. The tinny synth-pop setting suggests it might have been conceived as a joke. Indeed, you may get the most satisfaction from the album by resolving to regard it as comedy rather than tragedy. Strip away the presumption of intimate Swiftian knowledge and we are left with songs that bubble and stew but rarely crackle. Swift might be baring her soul, but the music can barely raise a temperature. Precious few artists can be wildly prolific without defaulting to the ordinary. The Alchemy, to pick a fairly random example, is not alone in sounding like a dozen other Swift songs. Fortnight is drowsy, shimmering 1980s pop. Clara Bow is a pithy little meditation on the Fame Pact and its cruel third act. Down Bad betrays the languorous, melancholic influence of the Blue Nile, a band Swift name-checks on the similarly rapturous Guilty as Sin. One of too few songs here which bothers to drum up a memorable chorus. The Smallest Man Who Ever Lived is a rare case of the writing transcending diary-level angst to land somewhere more resonant. Artistically speaking, score settling tends not to age well. On the title track, Swift sings, You're not Dylan Thomas, I'm not Patti Smith. Ain't that the truth? There is precious little poetry here, tortured or otherwise, only exposition. When the dust settles, I doubt this odd, untidy record will be regarded as a high point in her career.
And that's everything for this week. If you enjoyed those articles, why not pick up a copy of the Spectator magazine to read them and many more in full? I'm Patrick Gibbons, and I hope you join us again next week.